It's At the Letters for Thursday, August 18th on Sportsnet.ca and iTunes. Please like, share, favorite, and subscribe. My name's Arden Zwelling. I am at ATL Central here in Toronto. Dennickson Smith, my co-host, is off living a life of leisure this week on his vacation. But I've been a really good friend, and I've decided to pull him in off of his vacation to do a phoner with me on this fine podcast. You can get those spicy Dennickson Smith takes coming into your earbuds. So after this, we're going to talk to Ben. And then after that, we're going to talk to Ken Huckabee, who's manager of the Dunedin Blue Jays. We'll ask him about some prospects, some philosophy. We'll get an update on Anthony Alford, Connor Green, Sean Reed-Foley, all your favorites, and maybe some names you're not that familiar with as well. So that'll be in the second segment. But after this, Bendixson Smith on At the Letters.
Fly ball to right field. Pretty good wood on this one. It's gone. First extra base hit as a Blue Jay, and it's a three-run homer to blow it open here in the fifth.
It's At the Letters, Sportsnet.ca, iTunes. Arden Zwelling with you. Pleased to be joined over the phone by the vacationing Ben Nicholson Smith. Ben, how is your week of leisure treating you?
Very well. Yeah, it definitely is a week of leisure. A lot. I'm sitting right now on my balcony, so that's pretty good for a start.
There you go. You've got a lovely view of the west end of Toronto, I'm sure.
Yeah, pretty lovely. I mean, yeah, ready to talk some Jays. Got a coffee here, so definitely more vacation feel than usual.
That's good. The Toronto Blue Jays, winners of two of their last three and four of their last six and five of the last seven. This is my my take when I get the talk radio question of where is this team? They're winning more than they're losing. They're winning the majority of their series. And if they just keep playing like this, I have very little doubt that they can qualify for the postseason.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they're winning a lot. And it's now been the case since essentially the middle of May. So we're talking a three-month period where they've consistently been winning ball games. I mean, I think if you were to look back at the records in Major League Baseball since that series against the Rays, the Blue Jays would probably be what, number one, number two?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they're one of the best teams in the majors over the last little while. And what's, I guess, encouraging if you're a Blue Jays fan, the Baltimore Orioles falling off a little bit, Boston Red Sox getting into some injury troubles, New York Yankees sold off plenty of pieces at the deadline. I mean, this division is there for the taking.
Yeah, I think it is for sure. I mean, you look at the Red Sox, and I still think that there's a lot of talent there, and you know it's probably going to go down to the wire. But man, the Orioles are in a tough spot when you look at guys like Chris Tillman having his start pushed back, when you look at just the offensive troubles that they've been having since the All-Star break. I never thought the Orioles were that scary of a team, and I think that's really the way it looks increasingly as they start to scuffle here a little bit.
How do you feel about the Red Sox rotation right now? You know, David Price, Rick Porcello, Drew Pomeranz, and then a prayer after that? Is that what we're looking at?
Yeah, basically. I mean, Stephen Wright on the DL definitely takes their rotation down a notch, I think. And, you know, it's probably not a strength of that team. But, man, when I look at their batting order and just the depth that they have offensively, it does remind me of last year's Blue Jays team. And I think that, you know, the Blue Jays have a very good lineup this year, but we've seen it too that the 7, 8, 9 in their order hasn't come together, I think, the way the Blue Jays would want it to. So I think the Red Sox, as far as the lineup goes, tough to find a deeper lineup in baseball.
Well, yeah, I mean, speaking of that, you look at the Red Sox with, you know, just young, good talent right around the diamond. Mookie Betts, Xander Bogaerts, Jackie Bradley Jr., go on and on and on. Then you look at the New York Yankees, and all of a sudden you start, you know, you see, you know, Gary Sanchez and Aaron Judge and, you know, a lot of good young talent coming up for that team as well. It's a couple of scary teams for the future in this division in the New York Yankees, Boston Red Sox.
Yeah, I think so for sure. And I mean, you start looking at the Blue Jays and where they fit in there. And I think that the Jays definitely have enough pieces to still be competitive next year. I mean, the notion to me that they were somehow only going to have 2016 and then they were going to fall off, that never really stuck with me. And I think that as you start to look at this team for next year, they've got a lot of pieces, but I don't think they have as much talent as the Red Sox do. I mean, I think that the Red Sox are probably the best positioned team in this division long term, but for the short term, it's a different story. And for the short term, you could easily make the case, and you know, I don't know where you land on this, if you'd go with the Red Sox or the Indians or the Rangers, but I think you could make the case that the Jays are the best team in the American League right now.
Yeah, it's tough. I think Texas is pretty good with the additions they made, at the trade deadline. That's a scary team when you look at it.
Very scary. I mean, their lineup alone is just so stacked. When you add Luke Roy to that mix, when you add Beltran to that mix, I think that they have the kind of depth where off the bench you're having real contributions from guys like Profar, and they're just stepping in and contributing. And then on the other side, you have the Indians, who just have so much starting pitching and now relief pitching too, with Allen and Miller in that bullpen. I mean, that's a pretty good 1-2 punch late in games. I think the way they've been using Miller too, it just adds up to a really scary pitching staff in Cleveland.
Man, I wish the Blue Jays got Carlos Beltran. I wish so bad.
Yeah. I guess he would DH, and then Edwin would play first.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Melvin Upton Jr. thing kind of complicated it, right? Like if they could have gotten him before that move, but yeah, even after, you know, you could have found a way to fit him in.
You wonder, like, remember last year we ended up hearing, okay, the Jays were in on Zobrist and they came close to getting him, and it just never worked out. I wonder who those guys are this year that they were in on and, you know, pushing pretty hard for, and it just never happened.
I believe one of them's Jay Bruce. I think the Blue Jays tried to acquire him again, and you know, it just was, they weren't able to do it, because I do think the Blue Jays really wanted to add a lefty bat at the deadline, and I don't think they were able to. And not that many really changed teams, but I do think Jay Bruce is one guy that they thought, because we know they like him, we know they tried to acquire him in spring training, and he would have fit in nicely for what I think Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins were trying to do.
Hey, speaking of left-handed hitting Cincinnati Reds, I want to ask you about Joey Votto.
Wow.
So, do you think it would be worthwhile to put in a claim? So he has $172 million remaining on his contract, but he leads the National League in on base percentage and remains an elite offensive player. If he came across the waiver wire and you're the Toronto Blue Jays, would you put in a claim?
So let me preface this by saying this has been a topic for the last couple days, for whatever reason, that the Blue Jays are going to go get Joey Votto. And let me say that if you're looking at a management, or if you're looking at the Toronto Blue Jays and Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro, who have not extended Edwin Encarnacion or Jose Bautista, and you think they're going to take on 7 years and however many million with Joey Votto, it doesn't seem likely. Let me say that. If I were pulling the springs, I probably wouldn't either. It's $25 million a year through age 39, and then you got to buy him out of his age 40 season. I mean, as good as Joey Votto is, I just can't do that if I'm running the Toronto Blue Jays. Can you?
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. It's just, it's so much money. And, you know, if you're paying someone that kind of money, approaching $200 million, then you probably want to be getting that player's prime years. And there's a very good chance that Joey Votto's prime years are nearing their end. So, yeah, it would probably not be the right move, but I think it's a real question whether he's worth that money from here on, because, you know, you look at his season line, he's hitting .303, .427 on base, .509 slugging. He's approaching 20 homers. He is one of the top 5 or 10 offensive players in Major League Baseball. And you don't have that many chances to acquire those guys. And with the potential departures of Bautista and Encarnacion, Saunders, I mean, this offense could look a lot less imposing 6-7 months from now. And, it, you know, the thought occurred to me, and I agree, by the way, I mean, it's not realistic, but, it's the kind of question that I'm sure the Blue Jays or other teams around baseball would ask as these guys come across the waiver wire.
It's, if he had a more reasonable contract, I would do it. I think the Reds can be okay with paying that money because they got Joey Votto from, you know, age 24 through now. So they've gotten, you know, peak Joey Votto. They've gotten his MVP year, you know, all the All-Star years. I mean, they've gotten that. If you're the Toronto Blue Jays and you're taking on Joey Votto now, you're paying $25 million a year for, and you're banking on him continuing to be really, really productive into his mid to late 30s. and surely he can be good. I don't, you know, how, what are the odds that we're going to see this guy continue to be a top five offensive threat?
Yeah. And that's what it comes down to, I think. Like, if he was, so he and Paul Goldschmidt essentially have the same offensive profile, aside from Goldschmidt being a right-handed hitter, but they get on base a ton, not huge power. And I would say that if Goldschmidt, who's 28, if he had this contract, I would claim it.
Yeah.
But just because Votto's at this point 32, almost 33, you know, I think it probably is probably something where the Reds would have to kick in money if they're making a trade with another team, whoever that team is.
Absolutely. I feel like we haven't, just speaking of contracts and things like this, I feel like we haven't handicapped Jose Bautista's market on the podcast in a while. And it's been an interesting year for Jose Bautista. And, you know, I'm pretty curious to hear your thoughts as to where you think his market stands now with everything that's happened.
Yeah, well, being on the DL twice hurts him a lot, and his numbers haven't been there. So that's going to hurt too. I think that I would guess his ask would be a multi-year deal with an opt-out after 1 year. Right. And maybe the ask starts at, I mean, in spring training, he wanted five, right? That was the rumor. Mm-hmm. So does he still want five? I don't think anyone's giving him five at this point. So does that ask come down? I would think so, but it's tough. And these things can take on a life of their own too, where it's on the positive side for players. Sometimes the bidding just gets out of control. On the other hand, if you don't have a few really legitimate bidders, then you can end up being disappointed in free agency.
Absolutely. I would have thought coming into this season before anything had happened, I would have thought Jose Bautista, you know, coming into his age 36 season as a free agent, maybe he'll get, you know, a bunch of 3-year offers, and then whoever's willing to go to four might get him. I wonder if now you get a bit more creative with the contracts with Jose Bautista. Maybe it's a bunch of 2-year offers, and whoever goes to three gets them. And maybe you owe 2 years with an opt-out after one, or maybe, you know, you find a way that Jose Bautista can try to reestablish his value in 2017 and then try to re-hit the market again as a 37-year-old, which is a risk in and of itself. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, you wonder, you know, in other situations, like for younger players, this would be the kind of year where if you're 30 and you hit free agency after this year, you might try to reestablish your value and take a 1-year deal, bet on yourself and go out there. I don't know if that's at all on Jose Bautista's radar, but I think for younger players, that's probably what you would end up doing. I don't know if, as someone who's turning 36 before he hits free agency, I don't know if that's the path that he would choose.
It's interesting. You know, I wonder if the Blue Jays have a little window here to, you know, because they can negotiate with him right now. Nobody else can. And maybe, you know, if Jose Bautista comes back from the DL whenever he comes back, and I don't believe it's going to be right at the 15 days. You know, I think he'll be back probably end of August, early September. So he's going to have some time to, you know, hit some home runs, but it's going to take a while to, you know, find your timing and get used to seeing pitching again and this and that. I wonder if the Blue Jays have a little window here to, if Jose Bautista wants to save a little face and like maybe avoid the, you know, potential embarrassment of, you know, turning down a qualifying offer and going to free agency and not seeing the offers that he thinks he's going to see because of his age and because of what he's done this year and because of the injuries and on and on and on. I wonder if the Blue Jays can say, hey, let's work out a creative deal here that, you know, gives you something in terms of opt-outs or in terms of whatever, gives us some things in terms of options, or, you know, we can work in incentives. I wonder if the Blue Jays have a little window here to maybe get something done with Jose Bautista that's palatable to them.
It's an interesting thought. I wonder, I mean, how much money would they have to offer to even start that discussion? Because if they're offering a 1-year deal, let's say, with the player option tacked on, something that, you know, the front office may or may not be comfortable with, then it would have to be a big number, I'm thinking, to pry him away. Because at this point, he's so close to free agency and hearing what the 29 other teams think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I wonder if you went a year and, you know, a little more than 20, do you think that would speak to him?
I don't think it would. I think at that point he's testing the market and seeing what everyone else offers.
You definitely still qualify him, I assume, right?
Yep, I definitely would. I just think that because if he takes it, you're happy. That's the way I look at it with him. And even with Saunders, although, you know, that discussion may shift with Saunders.
No, that's the point I've been making, is that, like, you know, people are saying, oh, well, maybe you don't qualify him because what if he takes it? Great if he takes it. Phenomenal. If you have Jose Bautista next year for $17 million, that's a great outcome.
Yeah. Oh, that's a phenomenal outcome. And you're happy with that. That's almost the, I don't want to say best case scenario, but would you rather have Jose Bautista for a year or, you know, the 35th pick in next year's draft? I mean, for a team that's trying to win right now, Jose Bautista on a one-year reasonable contract, that's a great situation.
Absolutely. That is great. You know, speaking of contracts, and, you know, I don't know if we say this enough. I mean, the J-Hap contract, that deal looks remarkable right now with what J-Hap has done. That's kind of, you know, that kind of looks like the win of the offseason right now.
Definitely. I mean, even if you just look at the ERA, which is 3.05, as I'm looking at his baseball reference page, that's incredible. 150 innings. And, you know, it's a back of the baseball card stat, but the 17 wins certainly are eye catching.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He's making $10 million this year. He's already well exceeded that. He's making $13 million each of the next 2 years. He seems to have figured something out with this mix of fastballs that he's throwing, is the four seamer, two seamer, the cutter, which, I mean, his breaking stuff has almost become just kind of show me stuff that he uses just to let hitters know that he has it and that he can use it and that they have to think about it. But really, his process on the mound this year has been, I'm coming at you with my fastballs.
Yeah, and it seems like it's really effective. I mean, just based on what other major leaguers say about that fastball, Russell Martin, being the guy who catches it a lot of the time, is impressed with it. Josh Donaldson, when he was on MLB Network this week, was talking about Hap's fastball and how it can be really effective and tough to face. So, I mean, if, you know, staying on the free agency theme, if he were a free agent after this year,
boy,
I would think that, you know, he's looking at a 4 or 5 year deal, something like the, you know, the James Shields, Ian Kennedy, Jeff Samardzija, somewhere 70 to 90. That would be completely reasonable after this season, and the Blue Jays have him locked up much more reasonably than that.
Look at what the Royals are paying Ian Kennedy and what they're getting for that, and then look at what the Toronto Blue Jays are paying J-Hap and what they're getting for that.
Yeah.
And that tells you something about playing the free agent market.
Yeah, completely unpredictable.
Timing is everything. You mentioned Russell Martin. We want to touch on him. Russ started the year in a very, very deep funk. But since the beginning of July, we're talking about a guy with a 921 OPS. He's hitting 286 with a 403 OBP and a 518 slugging percentage since the beginning of July. The bat is coming around. But I think we expected it to come around, maybe not to this degree. I mean, I've never thought of Russell Martin as a 921 OPS guy. Which is really, really good. But I think that more than anything, his work with the pitching staff, his defense has gotten better. You know, he's throwing out base runners again, which is a nice thing. He's really rounding in form.
Yeah, it's been a pretty abrupt turnaround. Although, as you said, it's really been happening for a lot longer than this. I think that over the weekend, when he had that sequence of games against the Astros, and then, of course, leading into the Yankees series, when he was homering just about every game he was playing in, and also seemingly making an amazing defensive play, that's like, what a combination to get from your catcher. And it's something that the Blue Jays missed from him early in the year for whatever reason, whether it's injury or it just wasn't coming together. It certainly is now. And I mean, for the Blue Jays to get this from Martin as they're making their final push, if he can continue this for another 4 or 5 weeks, you know, that's such a key piece. You know, alongside guys like Donaldson and Tulowitzki, Martin, clearly one of the most important pieces as the Blue Jays try to push their way back into the playoffs.
I wonder where you stand on this. To me, Russell Martin is the player the Blue Jays can least afford to lose to a DL stint. Because not only do you lose his bat in the lineup, you lose his work with the pitching staff. Like, not only does your lineup get worse, your pitchers get worse as well. Are you with me on that, or would you go with someone else?
Yeah. No, I'm 100% on board with that, because even though, well, I'll throw one name out there. How about Donaldson? Just because he's so good.
Right.
I mean, that would be the only, because you can't pick a pitcher. You can't pick a pitcher because they have six in the rotation as it is. So, you know, you still would have a 5-man rotation even if you lose Aaron Sanchez. And so we've seen them get by without an outfielder, and that seems to be going just fine. You could go Donaldson, though, just because he is the MVP. But I my first impulse is to say, yeah, Martin's the guy that they can least afford to lose.
And I mean, your organizational options, you know, for whoever's going to take over at third base, I think are better than whoever's going to take over at catcher if Russ Martin went down.
Yeah, I mean, Darwin Barney has filled in really nicely at times. The idea that, let's say, Darwin Barney fills in at third for a week with Josh Donaldson in, that's fine. You're not really going to see a huge drop-off. But Toley is not going to give you anything close to the offense that Martin can bring. And I think that you're not going to get as much defensively either, especially now that Martin seems to be rounding into form with his throwing.
You mentioned the six-man rotation, and this is where it's going to get interesting, because the Blue Jays have off days surrounding their weekend series in Cleveland. So they've got one today on Thursday. They got another one on Monday. So you're rolling with a six-man rotation. We're going to see Francisco Liriano, Aaron Sanchez, and Marcus Stroman pitch in Cleveland. Coming out of that on Monday, I mean, you're going to have, you know, Marco Estrada, all right, Dick, EJ Happ, a lot of guys who haven't pitched in a week. It's going to be interesting to see how the Blue Jays manage this going forward and how long they stick with this six-man turn.
How long do you think that they stick with it? Because I could see it ending this coming week.
And what's the move? Is somebody going to the bullpen there, or what happens there?
Well, let's say, first of all, I don't know that they have the move decided right at this moment, but what if Liriano goes out and really struggles? I mean, at that point, you could bump him, right?
Right. That's the move that I prefer, really, just from what, and who knows, Francisco Liriano could turn it around and could become the guy that he was for, you know, the last 3 years in Pittsburgh. But I mean, the results this year haven't been great. And we've seen, even, you know, with the Blue Jays, while he hasn't been, you know, getting lit up, you know, he has been walking batters and he has been inconsistent with his command.
Yeah, he's kind of been on the low end of what you would have expected from him since he's come over here. And like you said, he could turn it around, but if he doesn't, it's not like it would be that difficult of a conversation. You point to the numbers. The numbers haven't been good this year, and he could still be useful in a relief role. I mean, especially on a team that doesn't have a lot of quality left-handed options in the bullpen.
It's interesting because, you know, the Boston Red Sox would love to have a Francisco Liriano right now. I mean, that guy would start every 5 days for them. When you're on the Blue Jays, you got three pitchers with, you know, ERAs around three. Marcus Stroman's been really good over the last 2 months, and R.A. Dickey does what R.A. Dickey does. Yeah, he's kind of on the outside looking in a few ways.
Yeah, so I think that if he were to struggle, I really wouldn't be surprised if that's the move. If he, let's say he goes out, pitches seven innings, you know, wins the game, eight strikeouts, one walk, that's the kind of outing that could just delay the Blue Jays' decision-making, and maybe at that point you run it through another turn or two. But I think that with all these off days, which, by the way, are probably a really good thing for this team, for any team at this point in the year, but with all the off days, it just, when you're starting once every 7 or 8 days and you have guys pitching as well as Sanchez and Happ, something isn't adding up there.
Yeah, it'd be nice if Jay Happ started every 5 days, right? He's really good.
Yeah, the way he's going. I mean, that's one of the things. He's at 150 innings, and you want to push that as close to 200 as you can before the end of the year to make sure that you're getting more innings from your best pitchers.
All right, Ben, we're going to let you get back to vacationing. We've got Ken Huckabee, manager of the Dunedin Blue Jays, on the other end of the break. But, Ben, thank you for joining us, and enjoy your time off.
That's the plan. Have a good one. See you next week.
Thanks, Ben.
What happened in the dugout between the two of you?
Maybe that's none of your business. Well, actually, you know, I told him after that first bat, you know, get a new bat, that one ain't working. I took the same one up there second time. That didn't work. He chose to break it, so I went down and told him. Should have listened to me. That was it. That was basically it.
You're a pretty intense player, and, you know, sometimes the cameras catch things, and they caught you getting a little bit angry there. Can you maybe explain your take of what happened there?
You know, I mean, I was just coming back to the dugout and hit my bat against the thing, and Gibby asked me what kind of cologne I was wearing. And I said, it's this new cologne called Tom Ford. I just got it. I was like, really? Oh. So he kind of got pretty close to me, and I guess got a good whiff of it. And I was like, hey, man, back up.
It continues on At The Letters on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. Arden's Welling here in Toronto. Very pleased to be joined by the manager, the Dunedin Blue Jays, Ken Huckabee. Ken, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Well, thank you. Very well. I love talking to minor league managers, hitting coordinators and pitching coaches and all that, because it's so interesting how your jobs are kind of two-pronged in that you are A, trying to win ball games for Dunedin, but also B, trying to develop young players and trying to turn young players into future major leaguers. I'm just curious how you manage those two elements of your job.
Pretty simple. I mean, the minor league development staff does a great job of putting together a program for each player, and the player knows that program, so he knows his schedule every day when he gets to the field. And I set out the plan early in the season that, you know, when we get to the field, you know, at 1 or 2 in the afternoon, that from 2 to 5, it's about getting you better. And then once, you know, that 6:30 time rolls around, it's about winning. Because, you know, we kind of believe that winning is a part of development. You have to teach people how to win and care about each game also.
You managed Lansing last year, and that was, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that was your first year managing. What was that experience like for you? You know, you had a really good season. You guys had 173 games, and, you know, Ryan McBroom had a really big year for you. What was that like, your first year managing?
It was the same. It was a learning experience for both me and the players, being the next player. You know, you kind of got to learn how that balance works between player and manager, and how to ride that line to get what you want out of them, but also know that there's structure built in the system for them to learn how to be a quality teammate when they get to the big league. So it was a learning experience for me, and you know, hopefully the players had a good time at the same time.
A guy that you've had both in Lansing and now in Dunedin is Anthony Alford. And, you know, I'm curious to know, you know, he's obviously a very raw product, played football for a lot of years, but has phenomenal physical tools. What's it like working with a player who maybe doesn't have as much experience with this game as, you know, as some of his teammates?
You know what? Anthony is just a quality person. The kid shows up every day with one thing on his mind, and it's to get better. And he's a special kind of player in the fact that he elevates the people around him, and because he holds everyone accountable for one mission, which is winning and getting better every day. So to be able to work with a kid like him, it's you can't ask for anything more. A kid that shows up every day with the desire to get better, a desire to win, and, you know, a desire to want everyone around him to smile and be in a good mood. It makes my job fun.
With him, is when it comes to the baseball stuff, I mean, where is he now with kind of picking up this game and getting enough reps and getting to a point where he's kind of learning the finer intricacies of it?
He's getting a lot closer. He, you know, our advanced meetings we had before each series, he's kind of starting to take charge in those meetings with the outfield and starting to set up the outfield where he wants it according to, you know, our information on the team that we're facing. He's taking the lead on that. His offense, he's starting to learn. You know, being a football player is a lot different than being a baseball player in the fact that in football, if you fail in football, the structure of the whole, you know, he was a defensive player, the structure of the defense falls apart if you don't do your one individual job. And he's learning now that in baseball, if he fails, it doesn't bring the whole machine crashing to a halt. And that's been a challenge for him, is to understand that, you know what, we're going to fail, you know, and anybody that tells you that they never struck out with the bases loaded, no outs in the bottom of the ninth inning is lying to you. So it's okay. You know, that's one of the philosophies we use here with my team. It's okay to mess up. You know, it's okay. We all do it. But, you know, we'll fix it after you mess up. So don't be afraid to mess up, because if you're afraid to mess up, you won't succeed.
Another guy who really intrigues me, who you had this year, and he just left you recently, is Ryan McBroom. And I remember I was talking to Kenny Graham, who's a minor league hitting coordinator for the Blue Jays, and he was saying, this guy is just like Kevin Pillar. And, you know, he reminds me of Kevin Pillar as a guy who gets overlooked, you know, he's not on, you know, number 1 through 5 on the top prospect lists or anything like that. But it's a guy who has a very real shot of playing in the major leagues. What do you think about Ryan McBroom?
I think the same thing. I mean, this is the kid that's got to prove it at every level because he was one of the high picks. He doesn't have the flashy glove, unlike Pilar, who always did have that flashy glove. I mean, he's got the flashy glove, but, this kid just shows up and hits. It's unbelievable. I mean, right now he's sitting, he's back here with me now.
Oh, is he? I thought he went to double A.
Yeah, he did, and he's been back for about 2 weeks now. Oh. And, I mean, in fact, he's in the middle of a 6-for-7 streak with a bomb, and it's this kid just hit me like Kenny probably said, he just shows up to hit, and positive attitude, and it's just, he's exactly like Kevin Pillar. It's actually a good comparison.
Another guy who I think has really kind of risen up prospect ranks is Richard Urania this year, who's had a truly great year. I mean, first of all, what are your thoughts on him? And second, what's happened with him to make him take such a leap in 2016?
What happens with him is, he's 20, 21 years old, young kid with tremendous talent. And I was fortunate enough to have him last year. And with Richie, we really just built a bond together. I just took special interest in how he was doing every day and made him feel like we were there for him instead of there to come down on him, which is the case with a lot of young players. They feel like you're coming down on them and they'll go into a shell and then you lose them. But Richie, this year, we just kind of focus a lot on his defense, and that's why he's taken off. We did a lot of video work with his pre-pitch, and we did a lot of early work on the backfields out here, and we really made him care about his defense, that it was just as important as when you step up to plate the hit. And he really took to it. He started caring about, being a shortstop. And it's probably the number one reason why he is in Double A right now, doing a tremendous job. And I couldn't be prouder of the job he's doing this day up there in New Hampshire.
On the pitching side of things, you had Sean Reed Foley come up to you this year, and performing really well at Lansing. What have you seen from him? I mean, we hear it's an electric arm, and he's got great stuff. But what have you seen from the eye test?
I've seen a guy who is focused on making the quality pitch. Every time I see a guy who's got a bulldog mentality on the mound, he's got a sense of confidence about him that, you only see in the big leagues. He's got this, you can't hit me kind of mentality. And once again, you're talking about a 20-year-old who has this kind of mentality. So the trick with a guy like Sean is to let him know, you're going to get hit. So when you do get hit, it's okay. Keep that mentality that you have, once you start getting hit. And but he, fortunate for him this year, he hasn't gotten hit very often. So it's been a good season for him.
What are the best weapons for Sean? I mean, I've seen very little video of him, but it looks like he's got a pretty good breaking ball.
He does. He's a four-pitch pitcher. His best weapon is obviously his fastball. Being a starter, he sits at 94, 95. And it's heavy, and he's got a really, really good curveball. Slider is very good. And he mixes his changeup in enough to keep the hitters off balance. But his weapon is his fastball. He attacks with it. It just makes everything else so much better.
Another young pitcher you've worked with a lot is Connor Green, I'm pretty sure he's up in New Hampshire now, but you had him for a handful of starts earlier this year. I mean, what did you see from Connor?
I saw Connor go through a little bit of a transformation with his mind, getting Connor to focus on what his main goals were on the year. And he really started getting it. And that's what earned him his promotion to New Hampshire. He really started focusing on his process of getting better each day he showed up to the field. And it started translating into his starts. And the whole thing about what we're doing here is, not necessarily, it's not always going to necessarily translate into success on the field, but as long as we're putting in the work, the right work, it'll translate eventually onto the field.
Well, for Connor mentally, I mean, makeup wise, where was he at before this year? What were the changes that needed to be made?
Not a lot of changes. It's just a matter of, you know, Connor's a young kid once again. And a lot of times, you know, we all remember when we were 20, 21 years old, what our lives were like and how our thought processes went. So it's just a process of getting a 20-year-old, 21-year-old to really hone in on what he wants to do with his life. Mm-hmm. And the focus has to be there every day when you show up of what's your priority in life. And, you know, every human being is different in the way they think. So it takes a little bit of time to get somebody to buy into his talent and buy into the dedication and focus and hard work it takes to become a Major League Baseball player, especially at 20 years old.
Right. Yeah, well, when you're dealing with somebody that young who's just out of high school and maybe isn't, you know, completely mentally mature yet, I mean, you've run into tons of guys like this in the game, I'm sure. I mean, what kind of tools do you use to get through to players like that?
One is there has to be discipline. There has to be structure, but there can't be the iron fist because then you lose them. But there has to be some kind of structure to them that says, you know, if you mess up, you're going to get punished. But also, think of it as being a father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to discipline your kids as you're growing up, but you also love them, you know, without question. No matter how much you discipline them or what they put you through, you know, there's that unquestionable love. It's the same thing when you're teaching a player to care about his career. You have to be disciplined and strong with them, but at the same time, they have to know that you have their back and that you would do anything for them. And once they believe that, then they'll start to perform for you and give you what they have.
Is one of the harder parts of that just the daily motivation of the daily grind of baseball? Because guys who are in the big leagues will talk about, wow, the grind will really get you down. And these are guys who are in mm-hmm. the big leagues. So if you're in mm-hmm. Dunedin or, you know, Lansing or where Bluefield, wherever, and you're getting into that grind, how hard is it to keep players motivated from a day-to-day basis?
It, you know what? It's a direct reflection of the staff. And so when I, you know, being an ex-player, you know, and my staff, thankfully, here is all ex-players. And we made it clear that when we show up every day, the grind doesn't show up on our face. And we show up every day the same as we showed up since April. We have the same energy, the same enthusiasm, the same structure, the same everything that we had back when we started this thing in April. And the players feed off that. They see we're not tired, we're going, and they kind of picks them up, you know, and you can walk around the clubhouse and get a feel for each player. If he's feeling it that day or not feeling it that day, and kind of, you know, give him a little special attention that day to try and get him engaged in what we're going to do that day.
Just to wrap up, are there, you know, I've obviously asked you about the big names you've had this year, but are there any kind of, you know, maybe young players that are a bit off the radar for us up here who we should be paying some more attention to?
We got our young catcher here is starting to develop into a pretty darn good player is Danny Jansen. He's 21 years old and he's big 6'2", 230-pound catcher that, you know, he's a very smart kid. And then, you know, our utility outfield, he plays every day, but it's Jonathan Davis. I mean, here's a kid that's hitting, you know, 260, 270 with 13 home runs and, you know, mid-50s RBIs already, and he's 5'8", 5'7", little tiny Ron Gant kind of player. He's like got 30 stolen bases this year and a very, very electric little baseball player. It's fun to watch and a big catalyst of our team here. There's a few guys like that that are a big reason why we are where we are, and our team is what it is because of, you know, JD and, you know, Danny Jansen back there.
You know, as a former catcher yourself, when you're working with a guy like Danny who came out of high school and, you know, has been kind of, he went through rookie ball, he's been slowly making his way up the system. I mean, how much do you have to work with him on, you know, kind of things like game calling and strategy and setting hitters up and things like that?
Constantly.
Yeah.
It's a constant communication going between us, and we all go through the same process he's going through right now. And he, you know, he's going through that, you know, he was not going through it now, but he's coming out of it. But he was through that little thing where he was afraid to call a pitch because he was afraid to make a mistake
right.
for his pitcher. And we all go through that as we're learning how to control a you know, call a game. And it's once again goes back to what I told you, where if there's no risk, there's no reward. So I, you know, we just reiterate to him, it's okay to mess up. You know, we're going to call bad pitches. Even when you figure this out, you're going to call bad pitches. And we'll just come in, we'll talk about it, and we'll try not to make the same mistake twice. And it's a fun process with a guy like Danny because he is very intelligent back there. And it's fun to see the wheels start to turn.
I wonder sometimes when people are looking at, you know, prospects who are, you know, coming up through the system, it's so easy to just look at what's his batting average, how many bombs does he have. But mm-hmm. when it's a young catcher, you think about this guy is trying to learn all those things that you were just explaining, and, you know, learning game calling, learning his pitchers, and it can be, you know, a rotating cast of characters sometimes. There's new pitchers coming mm-hmm. in all the time. He has to learn, and then he has to go hit. It must yeah. be difficult.
it's very difficult, and that's why it takes 5 or 6 years most of the time for a catcher to develop in the major league ready, because there comes a point, you know, right now where he might struggle with one and be good with the other, and then struggle with the other and be good with the other. There comes a point in your career when you get so engrossed in your defense that you really say, okay, you can separate it and say, if I fail on offense, it's okay because my most important job is behind the plate, you know, which is true. Because if he throws up zeros for 9 innings, your team's going to win. And if anything, he can do with the bat as a bonus. But you get those special few like a Russell Martin who can do both, and that's why he is who he is. But that's the delicate balance of teaching someone like Danny, who has power, who can hit and catch, is to try and separate those two and keep the focus still on both of them.
Those players are so rare that can do both. And, you know, I remember talking to John Gibbons the other day, and he was just kind of saying, you know, just talking with other managers around the major leagues, you get so many young catchers who come up now who have just teams just focused on their hit tool, and they focused on their hit and, you know, what, mm-hmm. what can you do with the bat? And they come up to the major leagues and they have no idea how to call a game.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's part of what we're supposed to, you know, what we're supposed to do down here with player development is try and remedy that. With guys like Danny Jansen and Max Pentecost and, you know, the other catchers, you know, Jimenez, we're supposed to remedy that and teach these kids how to do both so that they can make an impact when they get to the big league. Because, I mean, calling the game is and having a game plan going into a major league game is very, very difficult. There's a lot you need to know. And now throw in the knowledge you need to know the other pitcher, and the catcher's head will be swimming. by the time game starts. And so we need to start teaching these catchers how to decipher what they need to know for each game on both sides of the ball to make them the best player.
Absolutely. Well, Ken, thank you for your time. Appreciate it. Thanks for talking to us today.
No problem.
Our thanks to Ken Huckabee. Plenty of good stuff there. Our thanks as well to Ben Nicholson-Smith. Get him on Twitter at @BNicholsonSmith. Our thanks to Sam McKee. Fine producer on Twitter at Sam A. McKee. My name's Arden Zwelling. Next week, we'll be back to Wednesdays. We're on Thursday this week because the Blue Jays played during the day on Wednesday. So we're here on the off day. Next week, we'll be back to Wednesday. Might have a pretty cool guest as well. You're going to have to tune in for that next Wednesday on @TheLetters.